You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith, amateur radio operator W0NX, featuring the May 2024 The Spectrum Monitor. We'll begin by continuing Amateur Radio Insights by Kirk Kleinschmidt, NT0Z. NT0Z at stealthamateur.com. Modern Mentors. I did so, connecting the electrodes with HV-rated wires, and slowly bringing the supply up to full power with Variac, while carefully shaking salt into the water from on high. Each pinch of salt increased the conductivity of my variable load resistor, and I was eventually able to load the supply to full power, as measured on the amps B+ volt and ammeters. I noticed that the ammeter was wiggling a bit, and I wondered whether something in the high voltage chain was breaking down. Then I noticed that the water in the pan had started to boil. I was, after all, heating the water with almost 1,000 watts of energy. One of the copper electrodes was extra shiny, and its copper had started to evaporate under the intense electrolysis. This was a low-budget build, to be sure, and some of the techniques used to build it could be considered sketchy, especially today. But as I was building it, I was completely aware that the thing could kill me if I wasn't extremely careful at all times, which I was. I used the amplifier to work some new countries on 80 meters. A UA-9 station in Siberia comes to mind. But the weight and size of the amplifier, with built-in power supply, was bowing my operating table, which was moments away from collapse. I stored the amplifier at my father's place when I moved to Connecticut, intending to separate the power supply from the RF deck in the future. But in the 6 years that I was away, the amplifier got legs and walked away, never to be found. My skis suffered the same mysterious fate. Dang! Over the years, I learned that going from 100 watts to the 500 watts produced by a single 4400A is barely enough to be noticeable on the other end, and that I would have had much greater success on 80 meters if I had simply installed an inverted L vertical at 100 watts, instead of exclusively using low dipoles for low band DXing. But the amplifier was a tremendous learning experience for me, and a showcase of the Elmarine skills and tribal knowledge gathered by one Robert Sappington over decades of amateur radio operating, building, and wrenching, much of which in circumstances that required ingenuity and supreme scrounging skills. I suspect that we might be getting close to a time when a lot of this tribal knowledge will simply disappear with the old-timers who hold it. I hope not. Several years later, Bob became a silent key when I was away at college and my mother bought his house. Of course, the big high tower was no longer on site. Darn! Bob's basement was filled with World War II-era parts and assemblies, and he would sometimes ask me for help in cleaning and organizing his treasure trove. At the end of each session, he would give me lots of goodies. I didn't know then that he was probably using my youthful enthusiasm to get rid of junk, but it doesn't matter. Bob embodied qualities that I still admire today. He was a ham, a builder, a troubleshooter, and an engineer. He was generous with his time and his expertise. And he could fix stuff. David Newkirk, W9BRD. When I was working as a QST editor at the ripe young age of 26, I suddenly had a bunch of highly skilled Elmers at my disposal. In this era, unlike today, ARRL had a large team of technical editors, and these folks were always generous with their time and expertise. I was in hog heaven, as my father might say, and it was clear to me that, even in 1988, well before the present era, that if HQ staffers had an interest in building radio gear, the red carpets came out, as did access to the ARRL lab and its on-site machine shop. At the risk of not acknowledging many who I have always held in high regard, my standout Elmer of that era was David Newkirk, W9BRD, a call sign once held by Dave's father Rod, who was himself a longtime QST columnist. Dave, then AK7M, was a QST technical editor who happened to have an encyclopedic knowledge of receivers past and present, circuit design, performance characteristics, and arcane radio electronics esoterica, especially stuff from the vacuum tube era. If I had a question, Dave had the answer, whether electronics or editorial. And I learned a tremendous amount just by being in relative proximity. In fact, when I was a raw recruit, Dave had been writing a monthly amateur radio column for a popular communications magazine, a content for ad space trade by ARRL and CQ Communications, that was handed off to yours truly, the new kid on the block. In a twist of fate, that handoff from Dave started my long journey as a ham radio columnist in July of 1989. It is carried forth from PopCom to Monitoring Times to the Spectrum Monitor to this very column almost every month since. Who knew? Dave was a true RF whisperer. He could take a quick listen to a receiver and instantly tell you what was happening with the dynamic range, the characteristics of the IF stage, whether the AGC was working properly, the response of the audio stage, etc. As I have always maintained, Dave has forgotten more about receivers and receiver circuitry than most of us will ever know. He also introduced me to Gooch's paradox, which clearly states that RF has to go somewhere, the corollary being, but not anywhere that's necessarily useful. Much like Soylent Green is people, Gooch's paradox is real. When I wanted to build a tube-based regenerative receiver, Dave plucked a venerable and beginner-tolerant design from the 1939 ARRL handbook, and we set about tweaking it a bit to improve performance and add a bit of modernization. A vacuum tube voltage regulator was added to stabilize the main oscillator tube. Love the purple glow. And I added an MMIC preamp that sampled the tank circuit through a tiny 2 picofarad capacitor. Why? I wanted a regenerative receiver that has a digital readout. The display only counts when the tank is oscillating, of course, but that was close enough for government work. I eventually had to add a separate power switch to the external readout because the LED noise was hard to tame. But the readout is helpful in calibrating the analog tuning scale, which slews around a bit because of the nature of the regen beast. If I can find a way to increase the isolation, I should be able to run the display all the time. A design challenge for the future, perhaps? At this late hour, Elmers such as Dave Newkirk have esoteric knowledge that may not exist elsewhere. They're out there, hiding in plain sight. Finding face-to-face Elmerine in the esoteric radio arts, especially homebrewing, may seem all but impossible. But the Elmers are still out there if you can find them and wrangle an introduction. In southeastern Minnesota, for example, where I live, there are hundreds, thousands of hams. Most, of course, are not active. Most don't build radios. Most don't fix stuff. But there are hams in my area hiding in plain sight that have massive historically relevant vintage radio collections and the wherewithal to wrench on them. I have seen the backwoods Smithsonians with my own eyes, but I won't divulge the details for security reasons. Finding these like-minded folks is the challenge. I recommend starting at a local ham club meeting and asking around. If you find one of the specialty folks you're looking for, contesting, building, towers, antennas, etc., he or she can probably point you toward other members of the subgroup in question. You can also ask around at local hamfests if you're lucky enough to have any nearby. If you see someone doing what you want to do, step up and introduce yourself. Don't be shy. The folks you want to meet won't be around forever. Another good place to source the people you'd ultimately like to hang out with is via Craigslist and Facebook Marketplace. Recently, for example, I found a guy, a ham, who was selling some old ICO signal generators. Now, these are not really collectible and aren't terribly relevant historically, but they do make great cases for homebrew radios. If you were to take a closer look at my homebrew regenerative receiver, you might notice that it started life as a broken ICO signal generator. Before you call the radio police, note that, as a youngster, I destroyed many vintage radios in my quest for parts and knowledge. The ICO is among the lesser crimes I have committed. As we texted back and forth to arrange a meeting place, the seller of these ICO units sent me photos of the dozens of ham and shortwave radios he's collected over the years. Nothing crazy, mind you, but definitely noteworthy. He was hiding in plain sight. By day, a bus driver. By night, a curator. A local ham that I met over the phone during my QST days has a massive collection of ham and shortwave radios that fill multiple floors of his house. Many of these are one-of-a-kind prototypes and stuff you'd never see anywhere else. He's quite a character and is also generous with his time and expertise. We're trying to come up with a plan for rehoming some of his goodies after he becomes a silent key. Some of this stuff should probably be at the actual Smithsonian. No joke. So, these folks are out there, but they may not be easy to find. The Elmers who are easy to find are online, often on YouTube. While you seek out local helpers and experts, feel free to start online. Online Elmers. The internet is many things, but among my most appreciated aspects is the fact that I can find a video or two on just about anything. The heating element burned out on my clothes dryer? There's a step-by-step video on YouTube that shows exactly how to replace it, same make and model, saving hundreds. The same goes for swapping the carb on my snowblower, to building my garage extension, to sealing the driveway, stripping and staining my decks, etc. And there are thousands of amateur radio videos, too, on common and esoteric topics. You have to shop around a bit, as some videos in any category are made by newbies who don't have actual expertise, or maybe way off base. But many are posted by true subject matter experts, and these folks can do a pretty good job of remote Elmering, whether you're having a hard time finding local talent or not. In January of 2024, YouTube users collectively watched 1 billion hours of video each day. That's a bunch, and the staggering statistic shows how far we've come as an internet-using society over the past 20 years or so. Yes, there are millions of stupid pet videos, etc., but there are also thousands of priceless amateur radio and electronics mentoring videos up there as well, many of which contain levels of excellence that you probably won't find locally. There are other forums and formats used by online Elmers, from websites to podcasts to online communities and beyond. Providing a comprehensive list would take a phone book, and because I'm focusing on electronics design, construction, and repair, let me highlight just a few resources that I have come to rely on. The small collection should be enough to get you started if you haven't already begun compiling your own collection of online experts and Elmers. Mr. Carlson's Lab. If you have any interest in restoring vintage radios, this is must-see TV, Must Hear Radio. Paul Carlson is a Canadian YouTuber and Patreon content master who has a lifetime of experience in radio electronics and the esoteric knowledge of vintage radios and how to make them better than new. I'm 99% certain that he's a ham, but I haven't yet uncovered his call sign. Mr. Carlson's lab is probably the biggest, brightest, and best setup of its type in the world. If it's not, it's darn close. His test equipment has test equipment, and the set for his excellent videos uses the massive collection as a backdrop. His shop is so well-equipped, even if you worked at Bell Labs, Lawrence Livermore, or CERN, you might still have a severe case of shop envy, so be prepared. Sometimes, just for fun, he restores vintage gear while using vintage test equipment, and sometimes he uses a 20 GHz Rode and Schwartz spectrum analyzer. And sometimes he designs his own specialty test equipment and releases those designs to his Patreon members, which provides quite a return on investment for the $2 a month it costs to become a member supporter. MCL's videos provide step-by-step restoration procedures, laced with esoteric comments and practices that apply to a wide range of radio servicing and rebuilding. They're in high def and well-produced. His Canadian accent is even delightful. Actually, there's nothing that's not delightful about Mr. Carlson's lab. I give it 12 stars out of 10. X-Ray Tony B. Another respected YouTube Patreon expert in the vintage electronics arena is X-Ray Tony B. I think Tony is also Canadian. There must be something in the water up there. He's a medical diagnostic imaging equipment repair specialist who is really into vintage electronics. Although there is a lot of crossover, where Mr. Carlson specializes in vintage ham and SWL gear, Tony is an expert in fixing and restoring vintage and not-so-vintage stereo gear. The first time I came across one of Tony's videos, I actually thought that he might be Mr. Carlson from 10 to 15 years ago. They have a similar step-by-step presentation when it comes to restoring gear, and their videos are similarly laced with valuable comments and processes in general. Tony's lab is also drool-worthy, but nothing I've ever seen compares to Mr. Carlson's laboratory, which is probably in a class by itself. I love watching these guys work, and I can only imagine what it would be like to have them as local mentors. Interested in flying, and Chuck Yeager happens to live next door? Want to make sci-fi movies, and your cousin is George Lucas? You get the idea. Podcasts. Once Curiosities, podcasts are now everywhere and cover every conceivable topic. I ignore the plethora of true crime podcasts that seem to be favored by today's young people, and dig into my favorite electronics shows, which include Solder Smoke, which has been going strong for 20-some years, and the Ham Radio Workbench, on which I'm an occasional guest. I also like QSO Today, which does deep dive interviews, Linux in the Ham Shack, because I'm a Linux nerd, and Amateur Radio Roundtable, because I like the hosts. I am becoming a semi-senior refugee from the TVRO era. There's a big list here. player.fm/podcasts/amateur-radio. Online communities. There are at least 6 online communities, regardless of format, that support every possible radio and electronics niche. These include groups.io and Reddit, which offer free memberships and don't have much or any intrusive advertising. Actually, that might change, as Reddit went public today, after 20 years or so, with a morning IPO, And things that go public need money, and money usually means advertising. A variety of websites also support niche ham radio and electronics pursuits. One of my favorite is antiqueradios.com and its excellent forums. There are several others. Finding your way around the various groups and sites can be a bit tricky. Each seems to have its written and unwritten rules, and while almost everyone is helpful and tolerant of new members, some at each site distinguish themselves by being quite the opposite. Reddit, for example, is frequented by saints, Nobel laureates, and anarchists, and everyone in between. And the behavior of group participants can be similarly varied. Some subreddits, as they're called, have arcane rules and curmudgeonly enforcers. Be polite, participate as you're able, and move on if someone or some group is too unsavory. The good folks are out there. You may just need to find them. Be an Elmer. Let me suggest that, in your quest to find your own Elmers, don't forget to be an Elmer to others. As detailed here, although I didn't happen to have a tip-to-tail mentor who happened to live next door, I was fortunate to meet many excellent and supportive helpers along the way. In addition to my ramblings herein, I take every opportunity to provide help, support, parts, and non-obvious wisdom to the beginners I meet who are earnestly seeking. I bet you do, too. And now a feature article. Locking Up Next-Gen ATSC 3.0 Broadcast TV by Fred Baumgartner, K0FMB. For 100 years, with a few very brief exceptions, broadcasting has been in the clear. As many TSM readers recently learned, the newest over-the-air broadcast TV format is known as ATSC 3.0, or Next-Gen TV. It has been rolled out across the U.S. over the last 2 years and is now routinely encrypted using Digital Rights Management, DRM, software. DRM exists wholly to restrict select viewers from seeing and/or recording and/or sharing digital content. Content owners have good reason to want to manage their assets. Bootleg DVDs, password sharing, restreaming subscription programming, theft of cable, all unquestionably exist and divert revenue from the content owner to the bootlegger. Traditionally, broadcasting is the outlier in that legacy broadcasting had been advertising or viewer-supported. Legacy broadcasters wanted as many viewers as possible. More viewers means more ad revenue and supporters. Broadcasters welcomed translators, community antennas, and anything that helped get their signal to their viewers. Retransmission is an overwhelming change. Currently, a little bit more than half of a typical station's revenues come from multi-channel video program distributor, MVPDs, retransmission, known as retrans fees, and this is trending up. It is a simple and undeniable fact that a viewer who pays retrans subscription fees is worth twice as much as a cord cutter or lifelong free over-the-air OTA viewer. The business of broadcast and the cord cutter loophole. ATSC 3.0 is a toolkit. The vast majority of intellectual property that makes up the ATSC 3.0 standard will likely never be used. When the FCC accepted the ATSC 3.0 standard, encryption and DRM were part of it. We'll continue this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.